Samuel R. Delaney's been described as American science fiction's most consistently brilliant and inventive writer. Delaney didn't waste any time launching his science fiction writing career. He was a published author before he turned 20. In the decades since 1962, Delaney's published many novels and short stories. He's won 4 Nebula Awards and 2 Hugo Awards. In 2002, he was inducted into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame. Delaney's nonfiction includes the essay collection The Jewel-Hinged Jaw, Notes on the Language of Science Fiction. Delaney is a sentence lover, as he tells Steve Paulson.
The sentence, because it's made up of a string of words, that string is flexible. You can do things with the sentence, and the sentence can signal more things than individual words can. Back in the 1890s, Mallarmé said very famously that poetry was made of words, and for many people at the time, this was a revelation, because people during the Victorian era, and even up into the Edwardian, had tended to think of poetry as made out of sentiments, and that somehow the language was a transparent wall between sentiments and expression. And of course, it's not. It's the mediating material that actually makes a poem, makes a piece of prose rather than a poem, and makes it either a good poem or a good piece of prose, or a poor poem or a poor piece of prose. Single words don't do this. Groups of words do. Groups of words form clichés. Groups of words are original. That's why you need a full sentence at the minimum to express yourself with any kind of fluency.
Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering how this plays out then when you write science fiction, whether there's sort of the particular way that sentences are constructed. And in fact, you've talked about science fiction as a play of codic conventions.
Well, the point is the various genres are distinguished by the kinds of sentence conventions that they appeal to. Prose puts the words together in one particular form. Poetry puts the words together in another form. When the words are put together in poetic form, you listen to them differently. You pay attention to them differently. When they're put together in a prosaic form, again, you pay a different kind of attention to them. And it's the same sort of thing with science fiction. The kinds of examples that I frequently use are things like, "Then her world exploded." If you say that in a piece of naturalistic fiction, it's a metaphor for the emotional state of one of the female characters. However, if you say that in a piece of science fiction, you have to retain the possibility that it might actually mean that a planet belonging to a woman blew up. And because there are the alternate meanings in science fiction that are allowed in, there are different kinds of things that you can say. When you start looking at a whole range of specifically science fictional phrases with specifically science fictional interpretations to them, what you find is that in science fiction, again and again, collections of words that are metaphoric in naturalistic fiction are taken literally when they occur in science fiction, and it produces a different range of possible meanings.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'm going to ask a little bit about your background. From what I've read, you were a prodigy from early on. You were a voracious reader.
That $2.50 gets you right on the bus.
I want to ask about something else that I've read about is apparently when you were quite young, you went off to see a lot of tutors and psychologists because your spelling was really bad and your handwriting was bad.
I think much more to the point, rather than being a prodigy, I was also severely dyslexic. And so I had some, you know, severe learning. On the one hand, I tested off the chart, you know, as far as IQ was concerned. But by the same token, I couldn't spell the word paper 3 times correctly in a row. So I had to do a lot of extra work on my spelling and my writing.
Had you been diagnosed as dyslexic from early on, or did that only come
later?
Well,
no, as a matter of fact, they didn't diagnose anybody as dyslexic back then. People weren't even sure that dyslexia actually existed. When I was a child, I read voraciously, and I read everything you got within, you know, 20 feet of me. I would read it. Then I'd sit down and try to write something and it would be practically illiterate. And they were pretty sure initially that this was attention-getting behavior of some sort, and it wasn't. It was a perfectly honest learning disability. It was not until I was about 21 when they began to realize, no, there really is something that they can call dyslexia, and I had it.
Did that make a big difference to you once you had that understanding?
Oh, yes, it did. Yes, it did. It did. Because, I mean, for instance, I never knew whether it was attention-getting behavior, and I just didn't understand it myself. I mean, it was a very confusing thing to have.
So given your difficulty of, you know, putting words to paper, to actually spelling things, I'm wondering if that affected your development as a writer, if it sort of changed your way of writing.
Obviously, I think it does. For one thing, you get into the habit of rewriting things, because in order to do what the lexic do so cavalierly, you have to rewrite everything you write, every paper or a piece of writing that you write. You have to rewrite it 5 times, you know, just to get what people call the basic mechanics correct. That's what you have to do. You rewrite a lot.
You were the first major African-American science fiction writer, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In language, I mean, we've been talking about language was paramount to sort of the way you thought about your writing. Do you think you brought something new to the table there that really didn't exist in science fiction at the time?
I read a lot, not only in science fiction, but I also read a lot of literature. And I think I was perhaps willing to play with all sorts of rhetorical approaches to storytelling that not only were associated with, dare I say, hack writing, but also with literary writing. And I tried to use them all. The results, I hope, were slightly more interesting stories that were told in a slightly more interesting way.
Now, we've been talking about how you were really a pioneer in various ways. I mean, your use of language, the fact that you were this African-American writer in a genre that, you know, where there really weren't black writers at the time. You've also identified yourself as gay.
That's right, yes.
For a long time, I mean, since you were an adolescent, how does sexuality inform your work?
A great deal, from one end to the other. very much so, yeah.
Have you found that the genre that you've often written in science fiction, was that an especially good genre to explore questions about sexuality, especially for a gay man? I mean, someone who sort of was writing about things that perhaps early on were really not out there yet in mainstream culture?
It's interesting that the stories that first won awards, I and Gomorrah, and then Time Considered as a Helix of Semi-Precious Stones, they're the two stories that I happen to write that have something to do with matters gay. It's as almost as though the Science Fiction Writers of America, which is not a particularly gay organization, nor at that time was it particularly gay-friendly. If anything, you would have thought it was actually downright homophobic. If you look at some of the articles that appeared in their regular newsletter, but nevertheless, it seemed like that somehow the constituency of the organization was almost hungry for this kind of story. So that when these two stories came out, at, you know, more than a year apart, although there were other stories that I had written too, these are the stories that seem to suddenly attract all the attention and the ones that, you know, walked off with the awards.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know some science fiction writers kind of reject being categorized in that particular genre as if it ghettoizes them. And I guess I'm wondering if it's still useful to talk about the science fiction genre and, you know, to make distinctions between that and just fiction in general.
Well, I think the ghetto is something of a frame of mind. I can remember maybe 10 or 15 years ago walking into a bookstore that I went into fairly frequently, and there was a young woman who had a cart of books that she was shelving the books. And one of the books that was on the top of her cart was Don DeLillo's Ratner's Star, a novel that's about the government supporting some mathematicians who are trying to decipher some signals coming in from a far star. It's a fun read for a science fiction reader. And I said to her, you know, that's a really interesting novel. You should put a few copies up the stairs in the science fiction section. And she looked at me and she said, oh, no, this is a very good novel. And I said, yes, I know. I've read it. That's why I was suggesting you put it upstairs in the sign. And she said, no, that's crazy, and turned away. So I turned away and figured, well, I'll let that one go. And then I turned around, and the tears were running down her face. I mean, she was actually crying. She was so upset that someone had suggested that this novel by Don DeLillo, of all people, be considered science fiction, that she was in tears. And you realize that people have a huge emotional investment in keeping the genres separate. It's emotional. It's real. They will cry if you suggest that you break these barriers down.
Well, I'm wondering if we could finish off by actually having you read something from one of your novels. And I was thinking of the beginning of your 1984 novel, Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand, which I think has just been recently reissued.
So this is the opening of the prologue. "Of course," they told him in all honesty, "you will be a slave." His big, poured forehead wrinkled, his heavy lips opened, the flesh around his green, green eyes stayed exactly the same. The ideogram of incomprehension, among whose radicals you could read ignorance's determinant past, information's present impossibility, speculation's denied future. "But you will be happy." The man in the wire filament mask went on from the well in the circle desk. "Certainly you will be happier than you are." The features moved behind pink and green plastic lozenges, a shake on shaking wires. "I mean, look at you, boy. You're ugly as mud and tall enough to scare children in the street. The prenatal brain damage, small as it is, we still can't correct. You've been in trouble of one sort or another for as long as there are records on you. Orphanages, foster homes, youth rehabilitation camps, adult detention units, and you haven't gotten along in any of them. Sexually?" Lozenge tinkled against lozenge. The man's head shook. "In this part of the world, your preferences in that area can't have done you any good. You're a burden to yourself, to your city, to your geosector." Lozenges lowered just a bit. The man moved forward in his seat. "But we can change all that." He pushed back in the sling that was uncomfortable and costly. A blank and intricate absence on his face, he raised one big knuckled hand to point with a finger thick as a broom handle, for the technology of that world still made lathes, lasers, bombs, and brooms. The nail was gnawed almost off it, as were the nails on his other fingers and thumbs, crowding his wide palm's edge, whether flailing before him or loose in his lap. Those fingers seemed not only too rough and too heavy for any gentle gesture, but also, though, if you counted, there were only 10, too many. The finger, not the four, but the middle, jabbed brutally, futilely. You can change me?" The voice in his 19-year-old throat was harsh as some 50-year-old derelict's. "You can make me like you? Go on. Make me so I can understand things and numbers and reading and stuff." As brutally the finger came back against the horsebone jaw, a mutated herpes virus, along with some sex-linked genetic anomaly, had, until 3 years ago when the proper phage was developed, rendered the ordinary adolescent acne in the urban males of that world's lower latitude a red pitted disaster. "All right, change me. Make me like you."
Samuel R. Delaney reading from his 1984 novel Stars in My Pocket Like Grains of Sand. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Delaney's new novel is called Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders. Have you read any of Samuel Delaney's fiction? If so, what did you think of it? You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. You'll also find a link to our Facebook page there.